This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nicholas Kristof is a New York Times columnist who just returned from Iraq. His recent columns have started with him joking about how he was trying to help the Bush administration find those weapons of mass destruction. The mystery of the missing WMD, as he puts it, is a subject he's also taking quite seriously. Several of his columns have quoted current and former American intelligence agents who have told him that the Bush administration leaned on intelligence agents to exaggerate information that supported the case for war and to downplay or conceal information that did not. Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said, quote, "I have every reason to believe that the intelligence we were operating off was correct and that we will, in fact, find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive." We invited Nicholas Kristof to talk with us about his columns, including his recent reports from Africa. He's worked as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and has covered North Korea. Let's start with intelligence about Iraq. What are some of the most important things you were told by intelligence agents?
There were a lot of cases where intelligence was kind of goosed up to some degree. But I think the most striking case, at least in my mind, had to do with the uranium in Niger, because that was a case where it wasn't just that intelligence was kind of, you know, prettied up or some facts were neglected, but you really had something that had no credibility that made it into a presidential speech. And that had to do with the suggestion that Saddam Hussein was working on a nuclear program and was trying to buy radioactive material from the country of Niger to create a nuclear device. And it turned out that this had been around for a long time, that almost a year before the president's State of the Union address, in which he used that supposed fact, the CIA had sent an envoy, kind of at the behest of the vice president's office, to investigate and had found that it was completely untrue, completely not credible, that the documents that were supposedly evidence of it, you know, had names of people who'd been out of office for more than 10 years, that it was a very obvious fabrication. And this was widely reported, widely known within the intelligence community, and still was used by the president to argue the case to the American people in a way that I found deeply disturbing.
Now, Condoleezza Rice said that the Bush administration didn't find out that this document was forged until after the president cited it in his State of the Union address. And somebody else from the Bush administration said that the vice president's office didn't even know that this document wasn't credible until they read about it in your column.
Yeah, you know, I always thought that I should do a deal with Vice President Cheney that, you know, I'll tell him everything I know about what he's doing if he'll tell me everything he knows about what he's doing. And it seems to me on that basis that he, you know, in that case, he would have come out ahead. But he hasn't bought into that yet. I think it may well be true that the reports about the Niger deal being fake didn't circulate as widely as they should have. And I think that partly that's because the administration was sending out very, very strong feelers from the highest levels that what they wanted was evidence of nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons programs, not evidence that it was not happening. And secondly, though, I do know from talking to people directly involved in the Niger deal that the information did go to the vice president's office and did go to the national security staff in the White House and went to the top of the CIA. So, I mean, I don't know that it got to the president's desk or that it got to the vice president's desk, but there was clearly some major breakdown here. And so it may well be that Condi Rice is narrowly correct in the sense that the information that the Niger deal was phony did not reach her desk until after the president had spoken. But in any case, something went very badly wrong because the information was widely known, including at senior levels in the administration.
I think what you're suggesting is the possibility that if high-placed people within the Bush administration, including President Bush himself, didn't know about this, perhaps it was because they let it be known that they didn't want to hear any information that might discredit their case against Iraq.
Yeah, and I think that's what I found dispiriting about this, and that's what I think, you know, is key as we look ahead, because Iraq is behind us, but there are going to be other issues ahead, whether it's North Korea, Iran, or Syria. And I think it's as critical that the intelligence that is garnered about those countries be gathered dispassionately, without any political agenda. And I think that the system as it is right now is not doing that, that the intelligence community has been kind of subverted to serving a political purpose, as has happened at times periodically in the past at, under both Democratic and Republican administrations. But I think it's happening again in a way that undermines U.S. foreign policy, undermines our credibility, and that, you know, the intelligence agencies were set up to be independent, and they've really got to try to restore that.
Can you just tell us some of the things that current and former intelligence agents told you about ways in which it was suggested to them or implied to them that they needed to exaggerate the threat of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction?
Okay, I mean there are several areas. One is that the nuclear program, which is sort of the most ominous but also the least developed in the Iraqi overall military effort, was advanced and was a genuine threat to the U.S. They thought that was hugely pumped up. Secondly, that the biological and chemical programs were exaggerated so that they weren't just programs kind of in the background, but that they involved huge stockpiles and abilities to strike the U.S. Third, that Iraq had close connections to al-Qaeda, which seems not to be the case. And fourth, that people within the CIA, the DIA, and elsewhere in the intelligence community were really told to only pass on one kind of finding, one kind of conclusion, and that which was most incriminating of Iraq, and that the White House wasn't interested in, you know, a kind of thoughtful weighing of the issues or in its analysis. It was interested in evidence that could get into presidential speeches, for example. And finally, they said that one result of this is that the CIA in particular, and also the DIA for that matter, are deeply demoralized. And that's unfortunate because George Tenet, as director of Central Intelligence, really had done a great job of getting the CIA back on its feet, of managing it, of reassuring people inside the agency. And just, I'd say, in the last 6 months, there's a real feeling, particularly among the intelligence people, that they've been let down, that he hasn't stood up for them, that he let the Pentagon people kind of cut the legs out from under some senior intelligence people.
Well, in fact, one of the intelligence agents who spoke to you said that Tenet sided with the Department of Defense crowd and cut the legs out from under his own analysts. What do you know about that, that suggestion that he was so loyal to the Department of Defense and Donald Rumsfeld that he perhaps allowed information to be exaggerated to help the Bush administration make the case?
You know, the way intelligence works is that there's always just mountains of tips and information coming in, and a lot of it is bad, but you're never quite sure, you know, what is bad, what is good, what the pattern is. And I think that part of the problem was that people in the CIA didn't feel a lot of self-confidence as it was. They had kind of blown it in the run-up to 9/11, and they hadn't been sufficiently alarmed. And traditionally in the intelligence community, the way you protect yourself is you are very alarmist, and you see threats everywhere. And this time, they didn't really see it, but the Pentagon people were screaming, you know, connections with al-Qaeda, nuclear threat, chemical weapons, biological weapons, smallpox, and this kind of thing. And the CIA and DIA people didn't believe it, and they objected to some degree, but I think that they were also a little bit nervous that they were going to be, you know, sort of proven wrong again. And I think that that was particularly true of George Tenet, and so that when people in the Pentagon's intelligence shop started, you know, plucking out little bits of intelligence here or there to try to prove an al-Qaeda link, for example, that he was very nervous about siding with people who really kind of knew what was going on and signed on to assessments that were really largely, I think, ideologically driven and coming out of the Pentagon and coming out of the White House. Part of that may also be that he was not really part of the gang in this administration. He was a holdover from the Clinton administration. He's more of a Democrat than a Republican. He's somebody who has a good relationship with President Bush, maybe a better relationship with President Bush than he had with President Clinton. But he's not kind of one of the gang, and he may have felt a little bit insecure about his own position. I think it was a collection of reasons that led to this, to a real breakdown in the intelligence process.
How is the CIA supposed to be protected from a politicization of information and intelligence?
One of the basics is that the intelligence people, the spooks, are just adamant about that they don't do policy. One of the spooks I admire the most is a guy who knows North Korea really well. And because he knows it so well, I remember asking him at one point, what do you think we should do about North Korea? And he just looked at me and said, I don't go there. I don't do policy. And I think that, that's the traditional attitude. That's what the intelligence agencies are supposed to do. Beginning really at the end of the Clinton administration, the Clinton administration started involving George Tenet in the Middle East process, kind of in the policy of bringing peace in a way that I think in retrospect was a mistake. And then the Bush administration extended that and George Tenet was really brought much more into the White House kind of policymaking process. And I think that reduces the insulation that is there for the intelligence people.
My guest is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Kristof, and he's a columnist for the New York Times. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence is going to conduct a review of pre-war intelligence and how it was handled. What do you think they might be up against since this has been such a politicized process?
I'm not holding my breath on the congressional investigations. I just think that given who's leading them, that they're unlikely to be really aggressive and, that they'll poke around the ashes a little bit. But I don't think that it's going to be as thorough an investigation as it should. And I wish that there were a much more aggressive congressional investigation of this, and I think it's critical for national security that we do try to make intelligence honest again. I must say that I think that one problem with the political process right now is that it is so polarized that there is a sense that there are a lot of Democrats who want to investigate this not just to rectify the way intelligence is gathered, but also to use it as a club to beat the Bush administration. And that makes the Republicans, very nervous about going down that road.
The cover story of the New York Times Sunday Week in Review this week asked the question, did President Bush lie or did he exaggerate when he made statements like, intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. And he said that in a speech to the nation on March 17th of this year. Do you have any thoughts on where that line is between lying and exaggeration in this story?
In my columns, I keep using words like deceive or, mislead. And I keep getting these incredibly reproachful letters, emails from people saying, use the lie word. But I'm not comfortable doing so for a few reasons. One has to do with civility. I think that there's already enough incivility out there that, using extra epithets isn't really going to help. But beyond that, I do think that what happened was a process of systematic exaggeration rather than just completely fabricating things out of thin air. And that beyond that, I think that people at the White House and at the Pentagon, who I think were the leaders of this, that they believed what the bottom line of what they were saying. They believed that Saddam was a threat to us because of his weapons of mass destruction. I think they absolutely believed that Saddam had WMD all over. I think that the problem was more that some of these figures, especially the Pentagon, were ideologues who deceived themselves and deluded themselves and also deceived other people, than that they kind of deliberately concocted things and, lied to people. So it seems to me that the problem is not, one of lying as such, as of people being too ideological, not objective enough about the evidence, and creating a system where there were no checks on those ideologues.
Have there been supporters of the Bush administration who have tried to discredit your columns?
On the intelligence issue, actually, not so much. I mean, the thing that I've been really harping on has been the Niger deal, and there they do accept that the Niger documents were fabricated. They accept that this, even though they say they learned about it from my column, they do accept that, yes, it is correct that at the behest of the vice president's office, a former ambassador was sent to Niger to check that he said that, the documents were false. They haven't disputed any of those facts in the column. They say it's untrue that there was a sort of deliberate effort to spin things, but I say they haven't, challenged the accuracy of my columns, although they've challenged the interpretation.
Do you think what you've written in your column and what other journalists have written about intelligence agents who say that that information was exaggerated, that they were pressured to report only selectively on intelligence, do you think that that is changing the way the CIA is operating now? Do you think it is less probable now that information will be exaggerated or used selectively?
I think that's true right now, vis-a-vis, Iran and North Korea and so on. But I do worry that there is pressure among some of the political people in the administration to make a scapegoat of George Tenet and toss him overboard. And that would really put the Pentagon in the driver's seat for foreign policy as a whole. Already, the Pentagon has been kind of chipping away at the intelligence community and gathering more and more of the ability to, use satellites, to collect intercepts, to interpret things. Now it started its own intelligence shop. And I do worry that the result of this will be that you will get ideologues who will be in charge of the intelligence process as a whole. And if that were to happen, then I think, it would be a real step backward. And so what I've written is, I think that George Tenet really screwed up by not protecting his people, but I do not think that he should be forced out as a result, because I think that, ultimately that would be bad for the independence of the intelligence community.
Can you explain about this intelligence agency within the Pentagon that the Pentagon recently started?
Yeah. It goes way back in the sense that Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz had a deep, longstanding suspicion of the things the intelligence community were doing. They thought that the intelligence community had kind of become a big bureaucracy, that they just sort of shuffle papers around, came up with very conventional thinking, didn't come up with very good information. And so they started up, after 9/11, a small group in the Pentagon that would work with the intelligence agencies and look at raw intelligence and gather it out and pass it on to policymakers. I think one unfortunate result was that, the most alarmist intelligence was going on to the president, and you should be giving the president the best intelligence you have. Instead, he was getting some of the worst raw intelligence that came in that was unverified, and that shouldn't have been going even to low-level bureaucrats. It was totally untrustworthy.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Before becoming a columnist, he was the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. His latest columns have been about his trip to Iraq, from which he just returned. This week in your column, you report that it's looking like the Islamic fundamentalists have won in Iraq, or at least in parts of Iraq. What are the signs?
I'd say that they are winning, maybe, rather than they have won. I don't think that it's over yet, and I think things could go in all kinds of directions. But I think that the fundamentalists have really gained ground. What are the signs? One of the most striking is that Christians in the South are really living in great insecurity and fear. And part of that is that they've traditionally been involved in the liquor business. And, in Basra alone, there were more than 100 liquor stores. And Saddam protected them from the fundamentalists. Now, as far as I can tell, there isn't a single liquor store open anywhere south of Baghdad. There were fundamentalists who went to each store and threatened to kill the owners unless they closed up shop. In many cases, they smashed up the shops. They, drove vehicles into the shops, smashed up all the bottles, beat people up, kidnapped the owners. And in Basra, in two cases, they murdered the shopkeepers. And so the Christians are fleeing the South. All these shops have closed. You see it in pressure on women to wear the hijab, the head covering. A lot of shops have signs saying, sister, cover your hair. And the extremists went to Basra University, which is really, a model for equal opportunity in the Middle East. 80% of the science students are actually women, and a lot of the professors are women as well. And so they went to the university and asked that men and women have separate classes. They instructed women to wear the hijab. And that hasn't been entirely followed, but it certainly makes a lot of professional women and women students, deeply nervous about the future of the country.
Well, if a democratically elected government, either a locally run government or a national government in Iraq ended up to be an extremist Islamic government, that would put the United States in a strange position, because what it wants is democracy, but it doesn't want an extremist Islamic government to take over.
Right. I mean, I think it's a real conundrum that, we want democracy, but we don't probably want what most of the Iraqis would like to see, the kind of government they would like to see. For my part, I don't get the sense that it would be a, wildly extremist government. I don't think it would be like Iran, for example, with, real ayatollahs calling the shots, women having no role whatsoever in outside society. But I do think that it could be, a real step in that direction from the way Iraq is right now. And I think there are a lot of ordinary Iraqis, poor, uneducated Iraqis, who are deeply offended at the number of women who, do play a role in society, who go out alone or with other females on the streets, or, who, most shocking of all, date young men on their own. And all these things just grate horribly on a lot of Muslims in the South in particular. And, now is their chance to kind of design a country that they want. And I think that especially for girls and women, the result's going to be a step backward.
Did you see more chaos in this trip to Iraq than you did in your previous trip in April? Had things gotten any better or worse?
Actually, since April, I'd say it was about the same. It was certainly better than when the war was going on, and people were sort of shooting right and left, and you were always scared. You didn't know when you were driving around whether to put big, huge American flags and TV signs on your car to reduce the chance the Americans would shoot you, but increase the chance that Iraqis would shoot you. Or you didn't really know how to strike that balance. This time, there are a lot more cars on the road, and you feel somewhat safer than right when the war is going on. But having said that, it is a real mess. It's a scary place to be. Normally, I love to travel and go to all kinds of places that there aren't photos guides to. But Iraq, I must say, Iraq makes me nervous. There are a lot of bandits out, and you know their tactic is to rake a car with machine gun fire and force it to crash, and then steal its stuff. And that I had a friend who that happened to, and she was able to get away. I had another friend recently who she was driving along, and the bandits had dug a ditch across the road to force her car to stop, and they swarmed it and grabbed her backpack. At night, every night, I was using my satellite phone to check for email, and there's just gunfire all over. You know, it was great to come back to the U.S. this time in particular.
My guest is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof is my guest, and he just got back from Iraq. You've made a couple of recent trips to Iraq, but in between those trips, you went to Africa.
Africa.
Which kind of surprised me in the sense that, you know, you, like a lot of journalists, have been really focused on Iraq. So when you went to Africa, I was kind of surprised and, of course, interested to read what you had to say. But why did you go?
Well, Africa has been a passion for many, many years. When I joined the Times, I thought that, and I think they thought they were going to send me to Africa, and instead somehow they sent me to Asia, and I spent most of my career in Asia. But Africa has always been a long-term passion, and, you know, the stakes always seem so much higher in Africa than anywhere else in the world. If you get it right, you save so many lives, and if you screw up, then you lose so many lives because there's so many people right at the margin. And as a columnist, now I'm new to the columnist gig. I'm new to the whole opinion gig. And I found the whole period writing about Iraq actually a little bit frustrating because it felt like I was basically sort of, you know, stirring a pot that was already there called Iraq and that people were interested in. And it felt like I couldn't really write about other things because that's all anybody wanted to talk about. But that, you know, I wasn't really putting anything new on the agenda. And one of the cool things about having a column is that ability to bring something out on the agenda. And so the moment things kind of got calm enough that I felt, you know, wouldn't be derelict to my responsibilities by going to Africa, I went there, and there was sort of an incipient famine in the Horn of Africa, and it, partly because of the war in Iraq, it had gotten no attention. And far more people are going to die there than in Iraq, and it just gets zero attention.
One of the things you've written about in your Africa columns is the impact of the Bush administration's cut last year of the $34 million that it had given to the UN Population Fund. And you've been looking at some of the ways, you looked at some of the ways that the U.S. end of money to that fund has affected people in Africa. What are some of the things that you found?
The reproductive health care is just one of the ways in which you can help poor countries the most, because once you save children's lives for very small amounts of money, you save the lives of mothers for tiny amounts of money. Then they have fewer children in turn, as they know their children will survive, and they then provide those kids more education and so on. So the notion that we were cutting off funding to the UN Population Fund just went against everything I believed about how we can help Africa and Asia for that matter. And in particular, one of the issues that I think hasn't gotten nearly enough attention in the West is something called obstetric fistula, which doesn't get attention, I think, because it's sort of it's exceptionally unpleasant and sort of disgusting to talk about, and so everybody averts their eyes. But it's a condition that women develop in countries where they're very few doctors, very few midwives, and typically a very young girl, 15-year-old girl who's pregnant. Her pelvis isn't fully formed. She doesn't have a doctor, doesn't have a trained midwife, tries to give birth on her own or with her mother. The baby can't come out. After several days, the baby dies, and she gets these internal injuries, this obstetric fistula, which leaves her incontinent, leaves her smelly, makes her a pariah in the village, and her life is suddenly completely destroyed at age 15. And there are hundreds of thousands of these women. Nigeria may have 800,000 women just in Nigeria. And that $34 million, I mean, some of that money would have gone to help those women. I wanted to – so in Ethiopia in particular, I was trying to call attention to that problem. There's a wonderful program in Ethiopia that's kind of a model for the world.
So a fistula is when, the bladder or the intestines are punctured as a result of this problem delivery, and therefore urine or feces can just leak out.
And they leak out constantly, and the woman is always wet, stinking. Her husband almost always divorces her. Ethiopia, I talked to one woman who I think she was 15 at the time. Often they're also crippled in the process of this, with one or both legs. And she had given birth on her own out in the bush. The baby had died. She had crawled back. Her husband had been horrified at the stink, had left her in a hut at the edge of the village to die. Well, she didn't die, so he took the door off the hut so the hyenas would get her at night. She fought off the hyenas, then crawled for miles and miles to an American missionary who then took her to Addis Ababa, and she had this treatment to fix her fistula. And it's something that for about $200 one can get this surgery to treat these women. And all of a sudden, they're transformed and their lives are saved.
Okay, so the UN Population Fund funds some of these procedures to reverse the fistula. The U.S. cut off its money to the UN Population Fund. What was the Bush administration's motivation for cutting off money to the UN Population Fund?
It was the UN Population Fund association with the Chinese family planning program, arguing that the Chinese program is coercive and involves forced sterilization and forced abortion. And they're right that the Chinese program has indeed relied on force and coercion, is often completely brutal. They're wrong about the UN Population Fund kind of endorsing that or supporting it. On the contrary, living in China and watching it, it was very, very clear that the UN was desperately trying to restrain and was indeed succeeding in moderating the Chinese family planning program.
Do you think the Bush administration might reconsider this money?
I don't think so. Congress is reconsidering it. I mean, I think there are a lot of Republicans who are concerned about the cutoff of funds. I don't think that the White House will change its mind on that. Let me just give you one example of in China, the kind of program that the UN was involved in that just made a huge difference. Didn't have anything to do with abortions. China used to use a kind of IUD that just didn't work. It was very cheap. But it led a lot of women to bleed, to develop all kinds of internal injuries, and it was a disaster. But China was stubbornly sticking to this. And the UNFPA, the UN Population Fund, funded studies. It constantly pressured these officials. And China eventually switched as a result to, sort of international standard IUDs. And, the result on a Chinese scale is that you've got tens of millions or hundreds of millions of women who have much better health and, are able to bear children and so on because of the UN intervention. And this, is precisely what the Bush administration is insisting that the UN should not be doing. They're saying it should be pulling out of China. And I think that would be a disaster.
You were explaining that even though Iraq is at the center of the agenda for so many people, you wanted to report from Africa. I think we're undergoing a certain amount of selective compassion, where we're supposed to be like really compassionate about one group of people and kind of ignore the misery of another group of people. And it's true that you can't help everybody in the world simultaneously, but I'd just be interested in hearing your thoughts about selective compassion.
Yeah, I think that Africa, and in particular, I mean, the Congo is a great example of that. At this point, the argument for intervening in Iraq has basically boiled down, in principle, to a humanitarian intervention argument. I mean, since we haven't found a major weapons program at this juncture, and since we haven't found major terror links, the principal argument is basically that, hey, we've saved an awful lot of Iraqi lives, and that is certainly true. But if one looks at just the country of the Congo, the former Zaire, you've had some 3.3 million people die in Congo alone, deaths that would not have happened otherwise because of the war just since 1998. And, you know, there are not any easy solutions. I can't pretend that there are, but there are things that we can do to provide more help and that will ease the misery. And I think that we're going to be judged harshly in retrospect 20 years down the road when people look back and see the horrors that were going on in Africa that we did nothing at all about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. You used to cover China, and I know you've been following what's happening in North Korea. Do you have any guess what's next? Like, what are you hearing?
I don't think that the problems are resolved at all. I think that we're heading toward a confrontation there. And when that is going to break out, I don't know whether it's going to be the summer or the fall. But I think it's really hard to imagine a deal being worked out whereby North Korea is going to give up its nuclear program. I think that it's, you know, on the contrary, is developing it further. And the idea of North Korea with, you know, churning out nuclear weapons, kind of becoming a nuclear Walmart, is absolutely terrifying. But I think that we're kind of headed toward more confrontation and more brinksmanship there.
So are you suggesting that we're headed toward a confrontation with weapons inspectors or a war situation?
I think that what's going to happen is that the U.S. will be trying to put more pressure, both in terms of having the U.N. lean on North Korea and on having other countries in the region inspect North Korean ships, for example, for any kinds of armaments or nuclear items, and that those inspections are going to lead to more tensions. And then North Korea can ratchet up tensions on its part by sending warships south, by firing across the border, that kind of thing. And it can, we don't really know what is going on in terms of its reprocessing of its nuclear materials, but if it hasn't already begun reprocessing its fuel rods, then that would be the next step that would sort of throw us into a tizzy, because in 6 months it can produce enough fuel for five or six new nuclear weapons. And it may already be doing that. We don't really know. But if there are signs that is happening, that, you know, that will be the next big crisis.
Finally, Nick, I'm wondering if the Jason Blair story and the resignation of Hal Raines at the New York Times is affecting your day-to-day life at the paper.
I'd say that it isn't really affecting the way I do things. I'd say it's affecting my mail to some degree. I mean, it used to be that when I got emails from people, they would just say, you know, you're a raving idiot. Now they say, you're a raving idiot who fabricates things, just like Jason Blair. So it's made the email a little more colorful.
Well, Nicholas Kristof, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times.